True Crime Posse, and welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I'm Erin.
And I'm Shay.
Well, let's get right into it. Before our case today, we have two little announcements. These are the announcements that we've had for the last few weeks. The first one is going to be our big meetup going on in Austin. It's going to be us and a ton of other local podcasters from all around Texas. It's going to be a lot of fun. We hope to see you guys there. If you would like to come, I think we're going to be passing out maybe some stickers, some other good stuff.
Yep, we got some swag we're going to bring.
Yep, so it should be a good time. It's going to be at Rio Rita in Austin, and it's going to be August 25th at 7 p.m.
Yeah, it's our big Texas Podocalypse round two from Austin, Texas. I'm excited.
Yep, it's coming up soon. Should be a good time. Our second announcement is the fundraiser for Texas Equisearch. This has been going on for a few weeks now. Going to be continuing to go on for a few more weeks. And as you guys know, Texas Equisearch is a nonprofit organization. They assist in missing person searches here in Texas, across the nation, and abroad. It's a really good organization. We think it's a really worthy cause. If you go to our Facebook page or our Twitter page, or you can go to the actual Texas EcuSearch Facebook page or their website, any of those options, if you donate $5, you get entered into our raffle for All Crime No Cattle merchandise. That's going to include a t-shirt of your choosing, a water bottle or a coffee mug of your choosing, and some stickers, and of course, our thanks for being such a great person who is contributing to this worthy cause.
It's a heck of a deal.
That's right. And if you donate $20 or more, you get entered into a raffle that's going to be the raffle to end all raffles. It's going to be a ton of merchandise from us and a bunch of other podcasts. All of the podcasts that are contributing to this are listed on social media, so you can find all that information out there. And that's going to be like worth hundreds of dollars. So yeah. For a $20 ticket, not bad.
In fact, somebody just donated $100, which is awesome. I was super excited to see that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So again, we're going to continue running this fundraiser drive for a few more weeks, and eventually it'll be over, and then we'll announce the winners, and it'll be a lot of fun. So please be sure to get your donations in before the raffle ends.
Yeah, don't miss out. You ready to start our case this week, Erin?
I am.
This is episode 28, The Murder of Geraldine Davidson. So, as always, we're going to start out with our sources. And real quick, I wanted to mention somebody from Twitter. Our friend Danny emailed us, and he actually suggested this case, but it was one that I was already doing some preliminary work on, and I thought it would be a great case for the show. So thanks, Danny, for your suggestion. Apparently, great minds think alike. Our first source is going to be from the documentary series Killer Instinct with Chris Hansen. This is Season 1, Episode 7, entitled The Lady Killers, from 2015. Our next source is Wicked Attraction, another documentary miniseries. It's from Season 4, Episode 6, called See No Evil, from 2011. I also used a series of articles from the Palestine Herald Press by Paul Stone, who has been covering this case since early 2000 all the way to 2009. I used ABC 13 Eyewitness News and some of their publications around 2009, and I found two cool sources that I'm actually putting Erin onto for any cases we need these for in the future, one of those being the County Prosecutor's Office and their full archive of case files. This is really cool. There's a ton of information here, a lot of legal documents, appeals information, all kinds of really interesting stuff here. The next one is from caselaw.findlaw.com, which is actually a site that runs the Texas Court of Appeals archives, and this is where all of our appeals information is going to come from today. To start this week, let's paint a picture. We're going to be talking about Palestine, Texas, Erin. Have you ever heard of Palestine?
I have, only because there is a very interesting case out of Palestine, Texas, that I have really been wanting to cover for a long time. I'm not sure if I'm ever going to cover it, but I do know about Palestine because of it. I know that it is, southeast of Dallas, somewhere around there?
Yeah, so it's pretty much 2 hours east of Waco, and it's about an hour-long drive southwest of Tyler. So kind of in that triangle of places, Dallas, Tyler, and Waco. It's a smaller, quieter sort of Texas town, And in the 2010 census, they had around 19,000 people living there. So not a huge town. It's nestled in the edge of the Texas Piney Woods, and it's just north of the Davy Crockett National Forest area. It's a little different side of Texas that we haven't really described too much of, and it's not what a lot of non-Texans would picture that Texas would look like. You know, you're going to be thinking cattle, big wide open fields, oil pumps, that kind of thing. Well, this is large piney wood forest area with riverine areas pushing into swampy areas as you get closer to Louisiana. The town itself, though, is actually a really pretty one. It has a lot of large historical homes that are typically well-kept and unique-looking. The downtown area went to great lengths to maintain their historical buildings for the last 30 or so years, and this includes like various shops on the square, a big, cool-looking, huge antique courthouse, and a beautiful white Catholic church. Of course, there are some areas that are not so well-kept, but overall, I was really impressed by how nice this town looks. It's kind of like one of those places where we would probably stop off if we were just passing through on a road trip, maybe do a little shopping, get an ice cream, take a walk around the square.
Yeah, do some antiquing. Sounds nice.
Yeah. Would you like a sports fact about Palestine, Texas?
I would love one.
It is the home of NFL player Adrian Peterson.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even realize Adrian Peterson grew up in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I knew he was from the South. Adrian Peterson, as some of you may know, the longtime running back for the Minnesota Vikings.
That's correct. Now an Arizona Cardinal, I believe.
Yeah, he's been in some trouble lately. We won't get into that, but interesting. I did not know he was from Palestine.
So we spoke a bit about Palestine having a big historic Catholic church. Well, it turns out in this town, there's a handful of large historic churches all around town. And we're smack dab in the middle of the Bible Belt. Palestine definitely reflects that sort of religious, close-knit, small-town feel. Geraldine Davidson was known by friends and family as Jerry. She's one of the people that you probably would have known if you were a resident of Palestine back in 2000. She was 84 years old, but she still had a lot of pep to her. She was very active in the community. Even after she retired from teaching history and music at the local high school, she was volunteering her time to teach piano and organ to children from all backgrounds and walks of life within and around the Palestine community. She lost her beloved husband 15 years earlier, but was making the best of her retirement, and was also enjoying her independence. She loved her home that she had raised her three children in and had no plans of leaving, even though her three children constantly worried about her health and safety. They had since moved out of town. Geraldine had been a Palestine resident for over 50 years, and one of her sons, Paul Davidson, described her to Chris Hansen as, quote, a gentle lady, a homemaker, and an organ player, a church-going mother. She was a lady of grace that was loved by the total community, end quote. Geraldine's reverend over at Grace United Methodist Church described her as, quote, one of those ultra-committed types of people. She still had a lot of energy, and she really enjoyed the music ministry at the church. So let's jump to the evening of January 26th, 2000. It was a cold, wet, wintry mix sort of night, and Geraldine was expected at her choir practice as per usual that evening. She typically came early and stayed late to have all the music prepared and ready to go for rehearsal, so it was very surprising when she didn't show up at all. Of course, there was some bad weather that day, but once no one could get a hold of Geraldine, friends and family began to worry. They immediately called and reported her missing to the local police. Officer James Muniz of the Palestine PD was sent to Geraldine's home for a courtesy check. The officer first notes that her gray Buick, which was registered to Geraldine, was not at the residence. Officer Muniz knocked on the door. Nobody answered. He then used his flashlight to look in some of the windows, and it appeared to him that no one was home. A high window around the side of the house appeared broken when he circled around, inspecting the side. But he also noted in his report that it looked like it had been that way for some time. I thought this was weird when I ran across this part of his report.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty weird conclusion. What was his reasoning behind that?
Well, it was this. Nunez later notes that he had prior knowledge of the damage to the property during a potential break-in 10 days earlier, and he assumed that this was the cause for the window damage. The back door to the house was unlocked, which, as we know, is not atypical of a small town in Texas. So Officer Muniz took a second to peek inside, and he shined his flashlight around a little bit. Nothing looked out of place. There were no signs of a struggle either. He reported that he didn't see anyone and that the house appeared to be in a clean and good condition. He doesn't venture much further from the entryway of the back door, and he decided to go back outside and report to his superior. So let's take a second and we're going to go back to this mysterious break-in situation, okay? That was reported 10 days earlier. Her son Paul told Chris Hansen Geraldine's version of the events that day. Somebody who appeared to her as a teenager was knocking at the front door and asked to use her phone. Geraldine allowed him to come in, use her phone, waited while he used it, and then escorted him out the front door once he was finished. After which, she went back upstairs to her bedroom. Here, she discovered another person going through her drawers. Weird, right? Like somebody just popped up and appeared in their house in a different room.
Yeah, so like there was some sort of distraction with the one guy asking to use the phone, and then other people came into the house while she was busy with this one guy.
You got it. So she chases this guy out of the bedroom, down the stairs, and once they get to the bottom of the stairs, Geraldine discovers another young man is in her kitchen.
Ugh.
Yeah, that's just like mystery men popping up all over your house, right? Seems like a nightmare. They told her that they were looking for money, and after giving one of them $10, she told them to leave and never come back. Her daughter, Jaren, was interviewed on the Wicked Attraction episode and said she was joking about that, but she seemed proud of the fact that she was able to chase these guys off and get them out of her house by herself. Like, she was empowered by that a little bit.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. 84-year-old woman whooping some hiney. A bunch of teenagers breaking into her house.
Yeah. Well, afterwards, she reported the incident, but police were not able to make an arrest. Now, back to the case at hand. We have a missing 84-year-old Geraldine Davidson along with her vehicle. The family reported to detectives that she might have gotten lost or confused during the bad weather. Apparently, they had detected some behaviors in Geraldine, like memory loss or perhaps the early stages of another condition, like Alzheimer's or dementia. Therefore, it was feasible that a townwide search might be in order, and hopefully she would turn up. Geraldine's other son, Clyde Davidson, would later report that he had been trying to reach her for a day or so with no luck whatsoever.
Oh, wow. So she's actually been missing for a lot longer than what we thought at this
point. Yeah, Clyde said, you know, I was thinking maybe she went in to Tyler and went shopping or something and just didn't have time to call him back yet.
Okay, yeah. But so it's officially been about 24 hours since anybody has last seen her?
Yeah.
Okay.
An APB is issued to search for Geraldine's gray Buick in the surrounding area that night. Around 8:30 p.m., Officer Muniz leaves the home of Geraldine and starts driving southbound on her street, and he's just thinking to himself, if I see her car or any sign of her as I retrace her steps, maybe towards the church, maybe I can find out what's happened to her. Not too far down the street, just a few minutes down the road, he sees a gray Buick pass him. And he thinks to himself, oh, this is Geraldine. She's headed back home. Everything's okay. But just to be safe, Officer Muniz decides he's going to double check, pull a U-turn, and follow this gray Buick. When he does, the vehicle quickly accelerates. To Officer Muniz, this is weird behavior, and reportedly he had to speed excessively to catch back up to the car. He's still staying far enough away to where he can kind of follow it. He's not officially full lights blazing chasing him yet. He follows the vehicle at a distance for some time until it turns into a neighborhood that Officer Muniz felt, quote, that Geraldine would not frequent. I guess he means this is just a bad neighborhood.
Like a bad part of town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, at this point, he makes the decision to stop the vehicle. So the officer went up to the window, and there were five teenagers inside.
Hmm.
Yeah, the driver of which did not have a license. He didn't have proof of insurance. Neither he or anyone else inside the car knew who actually owned the vehicle when they were questioned by Officer Muniz at the scene.
That's a really bad sign.
Yeah, right? Where's Geraldine? What happened? Well, after running the plates, it's quickly discovered this is in fact Geraldine Davidson's gray Buick. The scenarios of lost and confused elderly woman who missed her appointment at church have quickly evaporated. The reality of a much more dangerous storyline starts to emerge. The five suspects are handcuffed, and they wait on the side of the road as detectives arrive and search Geraldine's car for clues to her whereabouts. The inside of the cab is extremely clean, almost as Geraldine would have liked it. She was a very organized, cleanly woman. But in the trunk, however, officers found a shovel that was dirty, rope, duct tape, and scissors.
Ooh.
Yeah. Not things Geraldine was known to have in her trunk. Immediately, the investigation switches to a serious note, and detectives begin thinking something terrible has already happened to Geraldine. The five teenagers, They're taken to downtown to the Palestine police station for further questioning, while detectives switch locations and begin searching Geraldine's home, this time more thoroughly. Detective Brian Wharton took point on the investigation and reports signs that something had gone wrong. Immediately upon starting the search, they noticed that the kitchen window had been broken from the outside.
So this was the window that Officer Munoz had reported originally.
Yeah, so this is the same window, but what makes them think that is there are glass fragments that are scattered all along the tile floor. And knowing Geraldine was a very clean homemaker, she would have cleaned that up from 10 days
previously. Well, I think anybody would have would clean up glass shards from all over their floor.
Sure, but her especially. She's not going to leave just glass in the floor.
Okay, so now we officially know that this is something that has happened recently.
Yes. Several drawers were also opened and had their contents turned out onto the floor. Upstairs, the bedroom was an absolute mess. Everything looked to detectives like a robbery. Also, on further investigation in the kitchen, suspicious similar rope fragments and cuttings are found on the floor underneath the overhang of the cabinets.
Similar to the rope that was found in the trunk of the car.
Correct.
Okay.
Detective Brian Wharton said during the Chris Hansen program that, quote, over the course of the evening, it was a building snowball. Every little bit just made it more and more imperative that we find her. The sense of urgency grows for a woman in her 80s. It just wasn't good. None of it was good. Well, back at the station that night, interviews continued with the five suspects. It turned out that they had rented the car from someone else in an apparent exchange for crack cocaine.
What?
Yeah. Well, District Attorney Doug Lowe clarifies the situation for us. He says, people in the community have used rocks of crack cocaine in other cases as a system of currency here. Money and crack cocaine have been used to swap for what's called a rent car.
I've never heard of that before.
No, I didn't realize that was a thing. And also, A, it's a bad idea to trade drugs for a rent car, but it also could be a car that a possible murder's happened.
Yeah, with. Something that's associated with a crime, and you're
going to look real terrible when you have that car.
Yeah, exactly.
That's apparently what's taken place in this case. The person the teens made the trade with was a known local with a history of trouble, and this is 21-year-old Danielle Simpson. According to forensic psychiatrist Dr. David Self and Texas Ranger Sergeant Rudy Flores, Danielle Simpson was known to use violent and angry behavior towards women in the past. One such occasion with an ex-girlfriend escalated to the point where the woman left her apartment and Danielle fired a shotgun through the front door at her. She eventually decided not to press charges, however, but he almost hit her with the shotgun blast.
Oh, God.
Dr. David Self goes further to state he believes Simpson had several psychopathic and antisocial personality disorder symptoms, such as using force and violence as a tool to get what he wanted, even against loved ones without considering empathy or consequences. Quote, other people's pain doesn't slow him down or stop him.
Okay, so this sounds like a very dangerous person, especially if this was somebody that crossed paths with Geraldine.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about Dr. David Self's evaluation of Danielle later, but you're right. I mean, he's just a very violent person who was also affiliated with local gangs. He had a handful of run-ins with the Palestine law enforcement. He was even on probation at the time for previous assault offenses.
Wow, and all of this before the age of 21.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so his legal track record suggested a history of living from place to place, stealing to get money for his drug habits, and violence against women. 2 hours after leaving Geraldine's residence, authorities have honed in on Danielle Simpson's location. Police arrive at the location to pick him up for questioning. It's cold, it's close to midnight, there's snow on the ground, and as officers go up and knock on the front door, one of the officers decides to go around the side of the building and shine his flashlight. He sees Danielle trying to escape out of a window, and a lengthy chase ensues.
And he knows this is Danielle, what, because he's had some kind of past interaction with him?
Well, when you go to pick up somebody and there's a previous case file on them, I'm pretty sure they give you a photo of who you're supposed to pick up. And he sees it's him, and he just bolts off through the snow. It's actually a really long foot chase that goes through the neighborhood, and eventually Danielle's able to escape through the thick piney woods nearby. The next morning, things take an even worse turn as a passing driver reports that they've seen what looks like a body in the Neches River near a bridge not too far outside of town. Investigators head out to the bridge and they discover the worst possible scenario is true. Geraldine Davidson's body is submerged in the clear water below.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they figured it out pretty quick because Lieutenant Leitner, who was a family friend of the Davidsons, was on the scene. And he quickly made a positive identification of the body. And Geraldine had actually been one of his high school teachers.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, it's I couldn't imagine finding one of my high school teachers dead in a river.
Well, especially in a way that's it's clearly not natural causes, you know.
Yeah, and let's talk about that a little bit further. You know, she had her hands bound behind her with duct tape. She had a pillowcase that was put over her head. And worst of all, rope was tied around her ankles that was attached to a cinder block to anchor her body down in the cold water of the river.
Oh, my God.
It's overkill, right? You know, it's just a terrible way to die.
That's awful.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Well, Geraldine Davidson did not know how to swim and was also terrified of water. Plus, the ability to swim is really taken away once you're bound like that and dumped into a river. Geraldine's body was taken to the medical examiner's office in Dallas, Texas, to determine the exact cause of death. And as it turned out, there was evidence of numerous blunt force injuries to her head, her neck, and her limbs, as well as parts of her torso. It looked like she had suffered a severe beating. There was also evidence to suggest that Geraldine had drowned to death. The autopsy showed that there was water inside of her lungs and evidence that she was still alive and breathing when she was tossed into the Neches River.
So basically somebody beat the crap out of her and then tied a cinder block around her feet and just threw her into the river alive?
Yeah.
This poor 84-year-old woman?
Yeah. Obviously, authorities are shocked and they're distraught. People knew Geraldine. She was a pillar of the community. And now the question remains, why would you do such a thing?
Yeah.
What would push you to do that? I mean, there's no motive for any family members associated with her. Everybody loved her, you know. By all accounts, she's just a sweet old lady. Well, later that day, after alerting the public of the discovery of Geraldine's body and that the prime suspect in this case was Donyell Simpson, a tip comes in on the location of Donyell's 16-year-old wife.
What? What do you mean 16-year-old wife?
Yeah, she's 16 and they are married.
How is that possible?
Well, we'll
talk. Can you get married at 16 in the state of Texas? Is this what I'm learning?
Yes. And we're going to talk more about Jennifer Simpson later on, and we're going to cover that. So don't worry.
Oh, God.
The tip was that Jennifer Simpson was at her aunt's house just down the street from Geraldine's residence. She goes down to the station willingly, and, you know, she volunteers for questioning. She doesn't resist. Jennifer tells authorities that she doesn't know where Donyell is, but fills in a bit more about his personality, his relationship, and a detailed version of what happened to Geraldine. She told detectives that earlier that day, January 26th, Donyell, his 13-year-old cousin Edward McCoy, along with herself, broke into Geraldine's home. Geraldine returned during the robbery, and the three of them bound her, gagged her, and put her in the trunk of her own car and drove off.
Wait, but why?
We'll get to that.
They were basically caught in the middle of a robbery.
Pretty much.
Okay.
And at some point later, they meet up with Donyell's 15-year-old brother, Lionel. Jennifer tells investigators that Edward and herself were present later in the evening when Donyell and Lionel threw poor Geraldine into the river. The four of them afterwards traded Geraldine's vehicle for drugs and then split up for the evening. This was the break in the case the detectives needed to start rounding up the rest of the suspects.
Yeah, that's quite a story.
Yeah.
So I have a question just right off the bat, because we know now that they had originally gone in to rob Geraldine's house. Was this robbery related to the earlier robbery 10 days before Geraldine went missing?
Mm-hmm. You know, Jennifer's statement to police is going to illuminate some of those details.
Okay.
So let's skip to 2 days later, Aaron. This is when investigators get a tip on the whereabouts of Lionel and Donyell. They're holed up in a known fortified drug house. Quickly, Palestine PD, they decide it's time to bring in the assistance of Texas Rangers and get some backup to go in and do a raid on a drug house.
Yeah, because at this point, they're probably assuming that there's going to be guns and all sorts of bad things in this house.
That's what they heard, and that's what apparently the term fortified drug house means.
Oh, okay. Because honestly, my first thought was like fortified wine. Or like fortified milk.
Just got a lot of like added high alcohol beverages poured in it.
Yeah, lots of vitamins as well.
Yeah. So assisted by the Texas Rangers and a strategic SWAT intrusion onto this house. Both are quickly apprehended and picked up. However, I need to point out that Danielle tried his old out-the-window trick again, but a Texas Ranger was ready and standing there with his .45 pointed right at him.
Yeah. Does he know that there are doors? Because it sounds like he every home he goes in or out of, he takes the window route.
He is a fan of the window.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm. Well, Edward McCoy is the last remaining suspect, and he is quickly arrested at his family's home.
And this is the 13-year-old?
13-year-old cousin of Danielle. Danielle refuses to cooperate with the investigators whatsoever. He doesn't say anything. The only thing that he did say was that he had ridden in the car for a short time, but that he didn't know anything else.
Oh, of course not.
Yeah. Lionel, on the other hand, he agreed to give a written statement. What do you think he said, Aaron?
Probably the same thing. I don't know anything about what happened.
Nope. He gave a detailed written statement about how Danielle had been planning the robbery and murder of Geraldine Davidson for weeks. Danielle was the source of all the blame. He said that he personally was minorly involved with the murder. He had nothing to do with the robbery. He helped him get a few things that he would need to get rid of Geraldine, but he did not throw her in the river and did not see her get murdered.
Okay.
All right. So we've got two of our, one with no story and one with kind of a weird story that doesn't follow the track record that Jennifer has laid out for us, right? So remember with Jennifer's statement earlier, she said that Edward and herself witnessed Lionel and Danielle severely beat her and throw her in the river.
Okay. And then so it's Lionel's story that I had nothing to do with that. That was all Danielle as far as mm-hmm. the murder goes. Okay.
With the added forensic evidence of both brothers' fingerprints being the only fingerprints on the trunk of the vehicle, investigators and district prosecutors began focusing their efforts on the two sworn statements that they were able to pull from Jennifer Simpson and Edward McCoy. These two statements match up really well, and they fit the same narrative, they fit the same timeline, they use the same statements and language from brothers Danielle and Lionel. They're thinking this is our best way to find out what actually happened and also get a conviction. So again, Danielle is no help at all. Lionel's statement was taken without consent of his parents, which makes it completely unusable in Texas courts, besides the fact that it's not a very good statement.
So why'd they even bother talking to him?
They made a mistake, and it was a clerical error that they figured out later on, and they weren't going to be able to use it anyway.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and you know, its contents weren't that helpful either, so they're looking really closely at Jennifer and Edward's stories. Let's start by outlining some further details of Jennifer's statement that will illuminate a lot of the reasons why things happened the way they did. So Jennifer met Danielle when she was in the 9th grade. She was enamored with him, and she quickly dropped out of school, and they began a serious relationship. Jennifer describes Danielle as a complicated, violent, possessive, abusive, charismatic, hot-tempered, and controlling individual.
Yeah, so you can see how a person like this could become the world for a 16-year-old girl.
Oh, yeah.
Well, 16 at the time of the murder, I guess she was, what, 14 or 15 when they first met?
Ugh. Yeah. Well, she ended up marrying Danielle, in fact, which we kind of touched on earlier, as a sort of loophole to get him out of jail for charges of sexual assault to a minor that had been received when they were both turned in for having sexual relations when she was only 15.
Explain this to me. So I'm assuming her parents or somebody said, hey, this adult is having sex with a 15-year-old girl, which is statutory rape.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to jail, and so she says, well, I'm going to marry him so these charges cannot be filed against him, so it's okay for her to marry him.
According to Texas marriage laws, individuals who are 14 years to 18 years old may, in fact, get married with the consent of their parents or legal guardians.
14?
Yeah. And that's apparently what happened. Apparently, she convinced her parents to let them get married. They get married, and he's let out of jail.
Okay, guys. Let's talk about how that makes no freaking sense. So it's against the law for him to have sex with her, as it should be, unless they're married. So unless this woman dedicates her life to him in a legally binding manner, it's not okay.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
That is That is messed up. And I had no idea, because I knew back in the day, because I've had family members who got married at 14 or so years old back in like the 60s or whatever. I didn't know that that was still allowed. That's still on the books, huh?
On the books to this very day.
That is absolutely disgusting. Because let's talk about all the parents. What kind of parent would sign off on their child getting married at the age of 14, 15, 16 years old? Probably not a good parent or one that has their child's best interests in mind.
One would hope none would sign off on that.
That's wrong. I'm just going to.
I agree.
That's my very strong statement on that matter. That is wrong.
I agree. Going back to Jennifer's signed statement, she detailed to detectives that well before Geraldine went missing, Danielle had started planning this robbery. He had apparently orchestrated the trial run of the mysterious prior break-in 10 days earlier. He was there, one of the people robbing the house the first time, and he knew just what to do this time around. He recruited his 13-year-old cousin, Edward McCoy, and his 16-year-old wife, Jennifer, and according to Jennifer, she didn't want to be a part of it at all, but finally relented after Danielle threatened her with another heavy beating. She had become accustomed to this. She'd actually gone to the ER a couple of times for heavy beatings from Danielle. They also had a child together at this point. So the three of them arrive at Geraldine's house earlier that day before noon. They found none of the doors unlocked. Danielle decided to break the high kitchen window and ordered Jennifer to climb in the window and open the back door from inside. And with that, they were in, and they began robbing the home, searching for cash and valuables.
Well, this is a really good question. So what was it about that initial robbery that made him think that this was a good idea to go back a second time? Because this is an 84-year-old woman. She's retired. Her husband passed away 15 years before that. She's had three kids. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like a situation where she's just has money stuffed all throughout her house, and this would be a great target.
I think what it was that Danielle knew the layout of the house. He knew where some of the valuables were that he wasn't able to get out the first time. And he kind of had been casing the place. Jennifer lived just down the street, so it wasn't too far away to keep an eye on and figure out Geraldine's habits and her routines.
Yeah. And just the fact that this was a little old lady who lived by herself.
It was easy, is what I think it was.
Yeah.
Well, just a few minutes later, Geraldine arrived home. She came in, she put her belongings down, but then all of a sudden her phone started to ring and all the burglars heard her phone. So they go into hiding places and Danielle is still downstairs. Well, before Geraldine can answer her phone, Danielle sneaks up behind her with a knife and grabs her. Jennifer sees this from upstairs happen. Danielle then forces Jennifer and Edward to help him restrain Geraldine. And he actually goes and finds some packing tape and a pillowcase. Jennifer said that she was told to place the tape over Geraldine's mouth while Danielle waited and then afterwards put the pillowcase over her head. Danielle and Edward then carried Geraldine out to the trunk of her own car and secured her inside. This all happened in broad daylight.
And nobody saw them?
Nope.
Did Jennifer say what the reasoning was as to throwing her in the trunk?
She had seen all their faces. And they were worried about her being able to identify them and the fact that Jennifer and Danielle had been at her aunt's house down the street. You know, she might know them from the neighborhood, that kind of thing.
But what were they going to do with her after putting her in the trunk?
They didn't really know. And so all three of these robbers, they get inside of Geraldine's car and they just start aimlessly driving around town trying to figure out what to do next. Jennifer said Danielle made a series of stops, and some of these were to score drugs and, you know, supply them with marijuana to smoke while they're figuring out what they're going to do. And the other stops were made to find information about how to fix their situation, such as talking to several friends and even family members about chop shops that were outside of town where they could dismantle Geraldine's car. And also some other affiliated gang members, and they wanted to talk to them and figure out what's the best thing to do with Geraldine.
Oh, well, here's an idea. Let her go.
Yeah.
You dummy.
Well, eventually he ends up stopping dozens of times and showing Geraldine off to everybody he talked to, opening the trunk and letting them look at her tied up in the back. And at this point, the tapes actually come off of her mouth and she's able to speak and she's pleading for her life. She's asking for her medicine. She even says things like, you can have my car and all my money. I'll just walk home. please just let me go.
Oh, God, that is so heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And what did these people do who saw her in the trunk?
They did nothing. They didn't help. They didn't call the police. It would actually come out later. And again, this is all in broad daylight, no less. It would come out later that as many as 24 eyewitnesses saw people either viewing Geraldine in the back of the Buick or viewed her themselves and did nothing. They didn't call the authorities. All they had to do was either reach out to the media. The media has already had a press conference about this, you know, or you could do an anonymous tip to the police. Like we've talked about before, it's not that hard. See something, say something, right?
Wow. That's almost unbelievable that nobody said anything.
Yeah, personally, I think this is the most upsetting part of this case to me. So many people had the chance to step forward and stop this situation before anything worse could happen. And it's just tragic. It really is. It's not that difficult. It doesn't take that much energy. And if you're a good person, you'll do that. You'll step up. Well, later in the afternoon, closer to the evening, Danielle picks up his younger brother, 15-year-old Lionel. If you thought Danielle sounded like a terrible person, well, Lionel may just be as bad or even worse, possibly. He had assault charges on his record, and he also even apparently attempted to murder his own dad with a baseball bat and beat him to an inch of his life, and the family later dropped the charges. Jennifer makes him sound like a younger, angrier version of Danielle, honestly. In her statement to authorities, Jennifer said that, quote, if Danielle hadn't picked up his brother Lionel that day, Mrs. Davidson would still be alive, and I believe that, end quote. She goes on to tell Chris Hansen that, quote, Lionel was more aggressive than Danielle. It was more so like that they should have been switched around. Lionel should have been the oldest, and Danielle should have been the younger, because he would always do what Lionel said. Jennifer also said once Lionel got in the car, he kept saying, quote, I always wanted to kill somebody, end quote. He was turned up. He was energized. Like, he was jammed to kill this lady. And I just can't wrap my mind around a 15-year-old kid that just is hankering to murder a poor old woman. But that's definitely what Edward and Jennifer both make it seem in their statements to police.
Okay. I mean, I can see all of that, but at the same time, they were the ones to throw her in the trunk and drive around town with her.
Sure.
Asking people, what should we do? So, I mean, I don't really see this ending any other way other than with her death.
Well, there was another.
Their whole worry was she's seen us. She knows who we are.
Sure. Well, there was another option in the cards, and we're going to talk about that in just a second.
There's always another option.
Yeah. Well, apparently
other than murder.
Apparently it had been brought up. We're going to talk about that here in just a second. So it's getting close to sundown. The foursome of criminals decide that they're hungry and they're going to stop at the local Jack in the Box. Okay. Jennifer went in. She goes to get the group's food order. And according to her, she discovered that she knew someone who worked there. She stated that she tried to get her friend's attention to let them know that something bad was about to happen. Of course, that's easy to say after the fact, right? But there is actually some evidence to Jennifer's claims, because there's some security camera footage from that Jack in the Box, and it pretty much shows exactly what Jennifer was saying. She even looks worried and nervous, like she's trying to like secretly tell her friend some information, and she keeps looking back at the door. But as soon as Lionel steps into the store, she immediately cuts off communication with her friend, gives up, finishes placing her order, and leaves with Lionel.
So it's her story that she was trying to flag somebody down, and without Danielle and Lionel's knowledge, and say, hey, this is what's happening, please help.
The friend also corroborated this, that she felt like Jennifer was trying to tell her something.
Hmm, okay.
And again, you know, this is another chance to save Geraldine that is just missed. They could have called the police, told them what was going on, where they had seen them, and they could have apprehended them before something bad happened.
Yeah.
Well, according to Jennifer, once they got back in the car, Danielle was making the case to drop Geraldine off in the middle of the woods and just let her go. But Lionel fought with his brother fiercely to kill the elderly woman. He wanted to dump her body somewhere. So this next section, I'm actually piecing together both Edward and Jennifer's statements. So Danielle drove the group to a secluded dead-end road near a bridge. Lionel got out, he walked over to some rubble that was nearby, picked up a cinder block, brought it back to the car, opened the trunk, and for seemingly no reason, smashed the cinder block into Geraldine and said, quote, I never liked white people anyways. He slammed the trunk one final time, and the group got back in the car and headed off to the nearby Neches River. Danielle found a dirt road that took them right up to the banks of the river itself. Lionel and Danielle got out and carried Geraldine, still alive, down to the river while Edward and Jennifer watched. Danielle and Lionel viciously beat Geraldine further by the side of the river. This is apparently what caused the contusions and the bruising that the medical examiner would find later. Afterwards, the two used duct tape to bind her more tightly. They tied this to the cinder block and the cinder block to her ankles, and together the two brothers swung her back and forth, one at her shoulders and the other at her feet. All at once, they finally tossed her into the cold, frigid winter Texas River. So the final thing that I'd like to point out about Jennifer and Edward's statements to police is it has a corroborating factor with the fact that the brothers are the only ones to leave fingerprints on the trunk of the car. And this matches up with their statement that they basically just stayed in the car all the time, and Danielle or Lionel were the ones to get out and deal with Geraldine. So now we have pretty much the whole story, right? And prosecution, they're moving forward with their timeline and Jennifer and Edward's version of the events. They assigned Dr. David Self to Danielle's case for mental evaluation. I mentioned this earlier. He does a full evaluation, and he diagnosed Danielle as a danger to society and having psychopathic symptoms related to an antisocial behavioral disorder. Both Jennifer and Edward agreed to testify against Danielle, and that was like the final nail in the coffin for him. They went up on the stand, they told their story, they answered questions, they did a really amazing job. On December 8th, 2000, 11 months after her death, Danielle Simpson was quickly found guilty of first-degree murder and was sentenced to death by lethal injection.
Oh, wow.
Of course, he went through his appeal process. He actually appealed like 5 times, and obviously he lost every one of them. Some of the things he brought up in his appeals I thought were interesting, like the fact that there were no minorities on his jury.
That's not cool.
No. And he also brought up insufficient forensic evidence, them just relying on the fingerprints. And invalid corroboration of testimonies was used against him, being, you know, his wife and a minor. The judges never bought it, though. They never upheld any of his appeals. And eventually, Simpson wrote a letter to the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals asking for permission to waive his remaining appeals. Quote, "I'm tired of being in an institution that's unjust, degrading, and corrupted." He also wrote, "Whereas on the other hand, I'm tired of struggling to survive in a system that's highly unjust. I'm ready to die. If I can't be free, kill me." It's weird, though, because right before his lethal injection was supposed to take place, he tried to pull like a, "I'm just kidding, I want to appeal again" situation, which apparently you can do in Texas. And sometimes that has worked. Governors have issued stays of execution in those situations before.
Hmm.
He tried to bring up some other legal matter about him not being in his right mind when he gave up all the rest of his appeals and he wanted to get a mental evaluation done, blah, blah, blah. Didn't work. So November 18th, 2009, almost 9 years after he murdered Geraldine, he is put to death by lethal injection. His final requested meal was 4 pieces of fried chicken, gravy, biscuits, and a glass of milk. He made no final apology in his last statement, and once he was strapped down to the gurney, he simply said, quote, "I want to tell my family I love y'all. I'm going to miss y'all. I'm ready. I'm ready." 9 minutes later, Danielle Simpson was declared dead as the 445th murderer executed in the state of Texas since 1976. He was the 22nd murderer executed in Texas in 2009.
Wow, that's a lot.
22, and it was November. They still had like a month and a half to go.
Yeah, that's a pretty high number there.
We are Texas. We like to lethally inject. What about everybody else in the case, Aaron? So Edward McCoy was sent to the Texas Youth Commission, and he was actually paroled in 2007 at the age of 21. He was set to serve the remainder of his 13-year sentence under adult parole supervision. Jennifer Simpson, who accepted a plea deal in her case, she pled guilty and is serving life with a chance of parole. And I believe she's up for parole in 2030.
Whoa, wow. She got life?
Yeah. She will be 47 if she's let out in 2030.
Wait, that doesn't make sense to me. She was 16 years old and she testified against him. And there's nothing to show that she had anything to do actually with the murder. I mean, obviously, we can sit here and debate Could she have stopped it? Could she have tried something? Blah, blah, blah. But let's remember, she was a child.
Yeah, I mean, it seems pretty heavy.
And she got life? I mean, with the possibility of parole, sure, but still, that's...
It's rough.
That seems like a very heavy sentence for a child going through something like this. Who we also have the verification that this is a guy who beat her up all the time.
Yeah, it doesn't sit well with me either.
Huh.
And I'll also go on to say that Edward and Jennifer are the only two people in this case who show any remorse for what happened. Like, they are really upset about it. They never wanted this to happen. They feel terrible for the family. You know, they've come out with statements about how terrible this has been for them, how it's destroyed their lives too. And I feel bad for Edward and Jennifer as just minors in kind of a follower's mentality. I mean, they were also doing drugs at the time and having these two vicious people lead them around and
taking advantage of them and manipulating them.
Yep.
And they were children. That's very surprising to me.
Well, Lionel Simpson was also convicted. He was convicted of capital murder and is serving life without parole because, as we know, he was too young to receive the death penalty, Aaron. He still claims his innocence to this day in the murder of Geraldine Davidson and blames everything on Danielle. If you want to know more about Lionel, or some people referred to him as Lionel, whatever it is, there's a really cool free 5-minute interview that Chris Hansen gives as part of his whole episode. And you can go watch that interview on YouTube for free. And I'll put that link in the description of the episode and with all of our social media stuff. So go check that out. You can actually listen to this jerk give his reasoning why he never did anything.
Yeah.
And why it's all his brother's fault.
I mean, it's so weird because he was only 15 years old. And it's really hard to sit here and say the 15-year-old made the decision to kill her or whatever. But we do have these eyewitness statements mm-hmm. that are saying that. I mean, I don't know. I feel a lot more comfortable with his life sentence than I do Jennifer's life sentence. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't know.
Well, a sentence that I'm not comfortable with is the one that was not given out to any of the witnesses that saw things happen. So, because of how important this case was, how much the media ran with it, and how much attention it got, specifically for the people who saw her in the trunk and did nothing, Texas now has a law in the memory of Geraldine Davidson. And it states that witnessing a felony crime and not reporting it is a criminal offense, and you can get up to 20 years.
Good. That's how it should be. Because every single one of those people could have stopped this and mm-hmm. saved a life.
Seriously, see something, say something, or you could go to jail.
Yeah. And that's how it should be. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being Geraldine? You have been taken from your house. You've been thrown in a car that's being driven all over God's green earth. And every few minutes they're stopping and showing you off to people. And nobody is doing anything about it. Nobody. I mean, the entire last day of her life was being hurt and being dismissed and not even being treated like a human being.
Yeah.
That's so incredible to me. It's absolutely disgusting. I cannot believe that nobody said anything.
And you know, for her, like being trapped in that trunk, every time it opened, she must have been thinking, oh, it's a chance for me to be saved. And yeah. I'm going to get out, or somebody's going to see something.
At least the first few times.
Yeah.
Until it kept going on and nobody did a thing. And then at that point, you would just lose all hope, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
That's just absolutely awful. And it's something that we've talked about a lot on this show. It's easy to believe that there are people out there who are complete monsters, who have no empathy, who don't act like humans. But to think that there are so many more people who would see something like that and not even do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said,
there are a lot more people who maybe wouldn't have done something like this, but could see it and still not say anything. It's
terrifying.
Almost scarier to me that there are so many people out there who would see something like that and have nothing to say and feel like it's not going to bother them if they don't ever report that.
Well, it's like that thing you always hear about big cities. I think it's like Chicago and New York. If you're being raped or robbed or beaten in the street, yell fire. Because people are potentially more likely to come to your aid if you're yelling fire instead of help, you know?
Yeah, it's that whole like bystander effect where if there are a lot of other people who are seeing the same thing, you can tell yourself somebody else is going to help. I don't have mm-hmm. to get involved. I don't have to do it. Somebody else is going to do it.
Instead of stepping
up
and
walk away
and doing the right thing, which is I need to do something about this.
Yeah.
I won't stand for this.
And there's the psychology of that is fascinating, but mm-hmm. it's also absolutely terrifying.
Yep.
To know that there are so many people who are okay with walking away from something like that.
Yeah. And, you know, Geraldine Davidson's family, I'll just have my few final thoughts are that they didn't particularly get any closure from the execution of Danielle Simpson. It wasn't gratifying for them. They had to relive the entire experience again 9 years later, and they didn't get any closure. He didn't even address them or say he was sorry, which that happens a lot when people are lethally injected. You don't get the final moments that you're expecting to get from that criminal. It brings up a lot of questions that Aaron and I also have plans for in future episodes where we talk about Texas's death penalty, the ethics and morality of it, and more of the technical parts of why we put people to death in the state of Texas. And is it useful? Who does it serve? And those kinds of things. So we have something in the works possibly with another podcaster that we're thinking about doing. So we think we have something neat there. But as far as her family goes, you know, they just have her memory. That's really all they have, and the trauma that they all went through.
Oh, and that must be just so heartbreaking, mm-hmm. knowing what she went through. Ugh, that is awful. This is a really terrible episode. That we had kind of a more upbeat episode last time to then go kind of right back into the trenches with a story like this, because this is just so depressing.
Yeah, there were a lot of like key Texas legal points in this case that made me really want to cover it.
Yeah.
And no murder is a good murder. And all these cases are tragic, but there's a reason why I covered this case, because, you know, the Texas marriage law, the Geraldine Davidson felony for witnessing a felony crime law that got put into place. You know, all that stuff is worthwhile talking about it. It just sucks that you have to go through a case like this to get to those points.
Well, at least we have Geraldine's memory, and it's something that we can all, you know, we heard about her and her story. And, you know, at least it's not in vain, because like you said, there are these updates to the law that now prevents, hopefully, from something similar happening. Mm-hmm. Or if it does happen, well, guess what? You're going to be thrown in jail for a really long time.
Yep. And we'll put pictures out of Geraldine in the prime of her life, you know. And man, she was, by all accounts, a really great lady. Hopefully we served her memory well in this episode.
Yeah.
Well, with that, are you ready for a break and some good news?
Let's have some good news. Let's remember that there is good in the world after a story like that.
Well, this is where we typically break for commercials, and we'll be right back.
Well, today's good news is another really awesome nonprofit organization that's been started recently. As we all know, we have a problem with veterans in our country, and that is that a lot of times veterans, when they come back from war, they have a lot of mental health issues, a lot of PTSD. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's very difficult for them to find housing, to find employment, and they also have a very high suicide rate, unfortunately. It's something that's really upsetting, because these are people who have dedicated their lives for our country, and they should not be having to then come back home and then deal with these kinds of issues that we can all help in.
Yeah.
And so that's what this one particular nonprofit, located out of Montgomery, Texas, which is kind of near the Houston area. And this nonprofit is called Green Zone Housing. It was started by a man named Mark Cook. And basically, he saw these issues and he said, well, there's something that I can help to do, and I can build a community around helping these people. So basically what he does is he turns shipping containers into homes for veterans. So when you think of a shipping container, you know, think of a big metal box, and it doesn't sound like something that you can turn into a home, but that's what this organization does, in partnership with a couple of other businesses that have helped as well. So there is one business that has granted them the use of some of their extra land to build these shipping containers on. And there's another company that they build shipping containers and turn them into houses just to sell. They take their profit margin from selling these shipping containers, and they turn that around and put that money towards Green Zone Housing build these shipping containers. It costs about $15,000 to $20,000 to turn a shipping container into a home. The home is basically everything on the inside is modified. So there is a bed that's installed, a shower, toilet, a cooking area. So there's like a little kitchen with a fully functional stove and all of that. So basically everything that you would need. It's really nice inside because they're, you know, completely modified. So they do like kind of wood paneling all around the inside. They install lighting. It looks very kind of modern and sleek.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a really cool thing, and it seems to operate kind of like Habitat for Humanity, where they basically find a family, and that family goes through the whole process and the application and everything, and making sure that they're going to be a right fit for this house. And then the family volunteers their time to helping to build the house that they're going to be living in. And that's what happens here as well. So the veteran who is going to be getting the shipping container that they're building that in that particular time will actually help to build and modify the house that they're going to be living in pretty soon. And it only takes about 3 to 4 weeks for these shipping containers to be fully outfitted and to become a home.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And so it's basically, it seems like a really cool thing. I think they just started a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a new thing, but they're still moving forward. They're hoping to create actually a little community full of veterans who need this kind of opportunity or this little help to get back up on their feet. It's going to be a community where it's going to be a bunch of shipping houses all together. They're going to be able to have that community built up. And they're also hoping to, you know, have vehicles that can transport them to doctor's visits or to the VA, et cetera, et cetera.
That's great.
They're going to have, they're hoping a workout room and like a worship facility and all sorts of things there in a little community. The veterans can then come in and go out as they see fit, as kind of it's necessary for them, but they're never kicked out. So if they need to be there for very long term or even forever, then that's a place that they can stay and they can have that as their house.
Wow, that's great. That's really cool.
It seems like a really great organization. I think this could end up doing really good things for the veterans who live in that area. Really cool. You can go check out more about this organization at greenzonehousing.com. They also have a Facebook page, and there's a lot going on about this organization in various news stories, so you can read up a little bit more about them. You can donate, because obviously they need funding, they need the money. You know, it's only $15,000 to $20,000 for a home, but that's still a lot of money. So they do need money, but they also take volunteers. So again, kind of like Habitat for Humanity, where you can go in and volunteer your time. And
yeah, we did that.
Yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can go in and volunteer and try to build up a shipping container to change it into a home.
That's always great if you don't have the funds to be able to donate. You can, but you do have time. Then it's so rewarding to go to a place, because our time at Habitat for Humanity was a lot of fun. We got to play with power tools. We got to help build the family that we met a home. And that was so cool.
That was cool. Yeah. We need to go back and do it again because it was a lot of fun.
Also, when I went down to Del Rio on a family fishing trip, we stayed in some storage containers that were converted to bunkhouses. And that was really neat. Mm-hmm. Like, I was so surprised how comfortable a storage unit was, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and I forgot to mention, they are, of course, outfitted with air conditioning, which is a necessity in Texas.
That one I stayed in, we put the air conditioner down, and it got cold in there.
Yeah.
And we were in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, this is fascinating. We're in a storage unit right now.
Yeah, and it's really nice. And it gives them the opportunity to where they're getting to stay in a home that they can call their own, as opposed to staying in a homeless shelter or something like that. So, you know, it's definitely a really great organization. Please do check that out if you're interested. Think about maybe giving them a little bit of your money or your time, as you were saying.
All right. Well, thank you for that good news segment. That was awesome. I have my palate refreshed. And the next segment of our show is where we do recommendations. And this week we got a real good one for you. This is one of my favorite new shows that I've just been tearing through lately, Pretend Radio. And make sure to stay tuned after the fact for Pretend Radio's trailer. But this is a podcast that is researched, executed, and run by this amazing person, Javier. Javier has like a background in radio and journalism, and now he works, I think he does another job, but he has a big passion for crime and podcasting. And you can tell the quality of his show is really, really good. It sounds great. He has good audio beds underneath it, and his research is just on point. So Pretend Radio is a documentary style podcast all about real people pretending to be somebody else. And so we're talking about people that are behind cults that are lying and trying to swindle somebody, so to speak. We're talking about snake oil salesmen, burglars, other types of interesting criminals that aren't necessarily serial killers or mass murderers. You know, they're just hoaxers. They're just sneaky ne'er-do-wells that are lying to you. And it's like the whole show is pretty much about the art of the lie and what's the criminal's background and their story and, you know, how they came to be who they are.
And what's really interesting is a lot of the episodes have interviews at their core. So you actually get to hear from people who have been affected by these hoaxers or by the hoaxers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really interesting. And he's got a great radio voice. He's very soothing voice. Audio is great, like you said. And these stories are just so fascinating. It's definitely one to check out.
Yeah. And if you want an episode that you can start with, there's a two-parter, which is his most recent set of episodes, but it's really good. It's about Martin McNally. And I'm sure a lot of you guys have heard about D.B. Cooper, the guy who robbed an airliner back in the 70s and jumped out of this full passenger airliner with a parachute and a gun and a bag of money and was never seen again. Well, Martin McNally is kind of like the D.B. Cooper that we do know, because he was caught and he was eventually arrested after a long, drawn out, very, very fascinating story. And I highly recommend it. Like, what made this dude tick? And what kind of detail that Javier goes into. And he's got interviews with Martin McNally himself. It's just a really, really fascinating episode. You should go check it out. Enjoy the promo, and it should be playing right about now.
At the heart of every crime, there's a lie.
In order to do this job well, you're going to have to learn to lie. But you're going to have to remember who you're lying to and when to lie and when not to lie.
But a lie is only powerful if you choose to believe it.
It all came out. All the story came out. It turned out he had 2 wives and 5 fiancés, that he wasn't marrying women because he loved them. He was actively impregnating women to rip them off for money, me being one of them.
So why do we fall for it every time?
My father told me at a young age, he says, Carl, the 2 easiest things to sell anybody: anything that'll improve their looks and anything that'll make them money. And that's what you want to sell.
Pretend Radio is a documentary podcast about people pretending to be someone else. I interview real con artists, snake oil salesmen, and former cult members, anyone living a lie. Search for Pretend Radio wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, it's time for the after show.
After show!
The best part of the show.
You know.
Not really,
it.
Though. That would be pretty bad if the after show was just better than the actual show.
That's a good point.
So,
we saved the goofs for the end, though.
Yeah.
Time to let our hair down, even though yours is in a bun.
That is.
And mine's in a hat.
Anyways, guys, so as usual, we always read our 5-star reviews as a thank you to those who give them to us, because they're brilliant. If you would like to give us a review, you can do so on iTunes or on Facebook, and that would be great. You can also contact us on social media. We are on Twitter at ACNC Podcast. We are on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. You can even drop us a line at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com if you'd like to let us know something.
You can also find us on PayPal if you just put in our name and drop us a tip if you want to just donate some ducats for us to buy some kibble for the canine crime unit.
Yep.
You can
look at them. They're practically starving.
I know. They're just skin and bones.
They're so hungry that they're just laying there. Not moving.
They don't even have the energy to live anymore. And you can also buy All Crime No Cattle t-shirt and merch and all that at our Threadless shop at threadless.com. One of our fans was wearing our brand new Meat Cut logo in China the other day, which I thought was awesome.
That was awesome. I liked it. Our first review comes from Facebook from Sarah Meunier, but I'm going to have you read this, Shay, because she has a...
Does she have a bone to pick with me?
No, she doesn't have a bone to pick with you. I believe that she would like this. Well, I don't believe. This is what she states. She would like this review to be read in a Swedish accent. So how's your Swedish accent there, Shay?
I think it's great. It's fabulous.
You think all of your accents are great.
It's renowned for its quality. I've won awards with it. Here it goes. Great high quality true crime podcast. You have become one of my favorites right away. Hugs from Sarah in Sweden.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry, Sarah. Although really, this was your fault, Sarah.
Wasn't that great?
Sarah.
Didn't you feel like you were in Sweden?
No, I didn't. Oh, Sarah, I'm so sorry, but at the same time, this is all your fault. So,
I think it's a treasure for all our listeners.
Next up is Kelly James, who says, great job covering Texas stories. Love the in-depth info and the good news at the end is a great touch. Thank you, Kelly. Next up is Lorian Nivet, and they said, just started listening / discovered you yesterday and already binging my way through to the most recent episode. Love the humor, poppers, and your interpretation of each crime. I'm a delivery driver and I get sick of the radio very easily, so I'm stoked to have found a new podcast to add to my rotation. Thanks, Shay, Aaron, and the K9 unit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Getting shout outs, babies.
Look Nelson, at you. What do you think about that, Nelson? Brienne, what do you guys think? They look thrilled.
They do. Nelson's just ready for a nap.
Hold on. Can I get Nelson to speak?
Sure.
Okay, Nelson, come here. Speak. Speak. Nelson, speak. Nelson. No, you gotta stay right here. Nelson, speak. Speak. Nelson, speak.
Speak.
Nelson, speak.
Speak. There you go.
Okay, guys, so we're going to cut out how long it took us to get Nelson to actually do that. But that was Nelson's speak. That was just for you, Lorian.
Yeah, he likes to see the actual treat.
Yeah, he does not trust us. And now he's very upset because we are not giving him a treat currently. You'll get an animal cookie in a minute, okay? Sheesh. Yeah, he is very dubious of you. Unless you have Snack in hand, he does not want to do his tricks.
That's true.
And so we had to go get him an animal cookie because that's what his new favorite thing is right now, are animal cookies.
He's a smart old bugger.
Yep. He's also lazy. Mm-hmm. All right. So the next one comes from Marshall Bingham. And they say, I love this. Just barely found you guys and I'm slowly catching up as I like to start new podcasts from the beginning. Each episode keeps me wanting more.
Well, if you like the beginning ones, then you're going to love these later ones where we're better.
Yeah, I think so. I hope. That's the idea, right? Uh-huh. Get better as you go along. Are we recording?
Yeah.
Okay, that was funny. Made me laugh, at least. I don't know about anybody else.
And our last Facebook review comes from our friend, Kelly Roberts. Kelly says, wonderful, well-researched podcast. True crime told with compassion, well-researched facts, and a little bit of humor where appropriate. So proud of you both.
Thank you, Kelly. That's our friend, Kelly. We love her.
You're the best, Kelly. Hope we haven't seen you in a while. You're a world.
I know. What's up?
She's a world traveler.
You don't
traveler.
Like us anymore? You go off to China and then you're just like, eh, I'm done with these two. Whatever, Kelly. Nah, just joking.
Enough with Facebook. Let's jump over to iTunes, Aaron.
Okay. First one is from Dear Emily 777, and they said, loving it so far. East Texan here. I hadn't heard of many of these cases. Kind of freaks you out when they happen in nearby towns. So far, there's plenty of detail, and they keep the listener interested. Y'all are also super cute. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you. You know who else is super cute, Emily? You.
All right. Next one is from NY Country Fan. They say, love it. Appreciate the lesser known crime scope. Love this podcast. The hosts are fabulous. I am a listener from Ohio, but similar to yourselves and your fans, have an intense interest in true crime. I love the state specific scope of these crimes on your show. Scary to see how many have actually come out of Texas. Listening to the episode 3, and this is the first case from your catalog that I have heard of. Great work. Love the K9 Crime Unit. Well, I have so many true crime podcasts in my list of favorites. You are the first I have reviewed.
Oh, that's nice.
Heck yeah. Thank you, NY Country Fan.
Yeah.
Go listen to some Marty Robbins or some Willie Nelson. She's into country.
Well, a New York country, though.
What? Oh, you think she's specifically only interested in New York country music? No, she probably is in New York and a country fan.
Oh. That makes more sense.
Yeah.
The next one is by Jolia3, and they say, Texans exploring Texas true crime with perfection. This wonderful couple have a great vibe, do their research, and manage to keep the dialogue clean without losing your interest. I also love the short story at the end that is uplifting. As a Texan no longer living in the state, I'm thrilled to have stumbled upon your podcast. Keep up the good work, y'all. Thank you, Jolia3. Mm-hmm. And we will continue to do that.
All right.
But only because you asked.
Yeah, just because you said so. Last one. YGWSW Pulp. They say, I was hooked when they made a casual reference to Popeyes the first episode. This is a fantastic podcast. Well-researched, great banter. It's exactly what you want when it comes to talking about Texas. Man, love that chicken from Popeyes.
Yeah, we did talk a lot about Popeyes.
Man, I don't think we've eaten Popeyes since, but I'd love for her to get some more.
YGWSW Pop, you are bringing back some memories. We're going to have to get some more Popeyes.
Spicy chicken, gumbo, beans and rice. Louisiana fair.
We always close the show talking about what we're about to eat. It's not going to be Popeyes, though, because I'm making healthy soup.
We're on a healthy diet of decisions that don't include Popeye. Would sound good, though.
Sad, man. Yeah. Does. Don't you think we could?
No, we can't. I'm losing weight. I'm losing weight.
All right.
Gotta look good. I gotta get svelte for that Austin, Texas podocalypse, man.
Yep.
Not much time left, though.
I know. I think this is just how you're gonna see us.
No. I lost 10 pounds.
You lost half a Nelson.
I did. I lost half of one of our dogs. So that's it from us, I think. I think this is finally wrapped up. Do you have anything else?
No. Not today.
Not till next week. And until then, you know what we say. Crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.